Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 29, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A bomb explodes at a mosque in Iraq, killing some 20, including a top Iraqi Shia leader. A Nigerian woman sentenced to death by stoning appeals her case to a higher Islamic appeals court. And we head into the Labor Day holiday weekend with some good news for low-wage workers in Florida. The city of Orlando passed an ordinance this week that will provide $3.35 more per hour than the minimum wage for city employees. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Striking workers at Yale University upped the ante today as dozens blocked city streets around the campus while members of the freshman class were moving into their dorms. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
Yale's two unions represent 4,000 employees. They struck on Wednesday for higher wages, job security, and better pensions. At 9:30 this morning, the first group of 34 strikers walked into a normally busy intersection, sat down in a circle, and held hands. One of them was Velma Williams, a Yale employee for 22 years who helped bring in the clerical and technical workers union back in 1984 with the 10-week strike. She says she's optimistic it won't take that long this time.
We have a lot more support. Everybody's out here. And that's the most important thing. We have a lot of community, the clergy. We have just massive support.
After a few minutes, police gave a warning.
We must ask you now to cease and desist, get up from the street, and go back onto the sidewalks.
In all, 83 people were arrested. They faced disorderly conduct charges and up to 1 year in prison if convicted. Conversations with random students, parents, and motorists who were blocked on the street revealed either apathy or support for the strikers and little opposition. The general opinion was that workers have to fight for what they get. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
Prosecutors around the nation are trying to curb people's rights to use DNA evidence to show they are innocent. Sally Watt reports from St. Petersburg, Florida.
More than 130 prisoners across the country have been released in the last 15 years using DNA testing, but some prosecutors are now saying that in many of these cases, more than DNA evidence alone is needed to overturn a sentence. Defense attorneys say physical evidence used to convict a person that later turns out to belong to someone else should be considered proof of innocence. In Florida, inmates face an October 1st deadline to get their cases heard. In 2001, the state legislature gave them 2 years to file. Defense attorneys say they've received over 200 requests and will ask the Florida Supreme Court to extend the deadline. Reporting for Free Speech Radio, I'm Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
Air Force officials are facing internal statistics that mirror the general population on numbers of women who are sexually assaulted. Daniel Costello reports from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado.
The draft report, which was not officially released, tallies surveys given to women from the Academy this spring. Almost 70% of the 579 respondents say they were victims of sexual harassment there. 80% of the attacks were not reported. Air Force Academy officials have expressed surprise about the extent of the problem as the sexual misconduct scandal has developed, but a national study of college women has shown similar figures for rape and sexual assault. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Daniel Costello in Denver.
At the United Nations, diplomats are discussing the apparent softening of the U.S. position on maintaining a military exclusive in Iraq and will consider sending a U.N.-authorized peacekeeping force. Heather Risby has more.
Diplomats here say the proposal is a non-starter because it is not in line with the demand of France, Germany, Russia, and India. These countries are saying if the U.S. wants a multinational force in Iraq, then it must give up the idea that such a force will be commanded by a U.S. general. France said it wanted more than a cosmetic change in the existing security situation in Iraq. And Kofi Annan, the U.N. Secretary General, in a way agreed with him. Talking about the multinational force the other day, he said, in the absence of shared decisions and responsibilities, it will be difficult to get a resolution that will satisfy everybody. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
One prominent Silicon Valley venture capital firm tells the universities of California and Michigan they would rather keep their corporate books private than have them as investors. From KPFA, Kelly Ramirez reports.
Sequoia Capital, which helped technology giants Oracle, Yahoo, and Google in their startup days, says it wants to keep its investor information private for competitive reasons and would rather sever its relationships with Cal and Michigan than expose its books. Newspapers and other organizations are using the Freedom of Information Act to find out how much public universities and pension funds lost in the dot-com bust. Courts are siding with the public's right to know, requiring public institutions to disclose the results of their venture capital investments. According to a sworn declaration by University of California Treasurer David Russ, Cal has invested $110 million in Sequoia and reaped a $508 million return. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez in Berkeley, California.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Soon after Friday morning prayers began in a mosque in the Shiite holy city of Najaf in Iraq, a powerful car bomb exploded outside the mosque, killing some and injuring scores more. Among the dead is influential Shia leader Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim. Our correspondent Ahmed al-Rawi spoke to us from Baghdad shortly after the blast. Tell us about the Shia leader who died in the bomb blast today.
Well, actually, this Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim is the leader of the Shiite religious group called the Supreme Council or the Supreme Assembly of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Today he has been killed by a car blast near Imam Ali Mosque in Najaf City. This city is famous for Imam Ali, who used to be the original leader of the Shiites in the world. He was killed and no one till now took responsibility of the attack. But 20 people with him were killed and at least 15 were injured. This happened before the Friday prayer of the Muslims today.
Now, can you tell us something about the timing of the blast and also the significance of the fact that the bomb was planted in Najaf, a Shia strong city?
There is a great confusion because no one knows the actual motives behind the attack. And no one knows who really would benefit from such an attack. But some of the Shiite leaders interviewed in televisions, they claim that it may be one of the followers of the former regime of Saddam Hussein trying to destabilize the country by such an attack. You know, Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim has spent 23 years of his life in Iran, because he was leading an oppositional group and an army called Al-Badr Army. It is just like a militia. And he was opposing Saddam Hussein's rule from Iran. After the war, he returned to Iraq and began to preach Shiite Muslims about the teachings of their religion.
Do you think the blast was caused by Sunni Muslims because of the tension between Sunni and Shia Muslims?
Well, actually, you know, Iraq has been ruled for many years by the minority Sunni group, the Sunni groups of Islam. Now, there are some Sunni oppositional groups claiming that they may make some attacks against the Shiites leading groups. For example, there was this group recently shown on Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera TV. They said that they may attack anyone, any member of the Iraqi Governing Council. Of course, they were Sunnis. But in Iraq now, I don't think that it's just a matter of discrimination between religious groups. It's far beyond that. It's a political matter. So maybe it's a revenge that you were opposing me and now you are ruling because you have one of your members in the Iraqi Governing Council, I will attack you. This is an option, but it's just an option. I mean, no one knows till now who would benefit from such an attack.
FSRN correspondent Ahmed al-Rawi joining us from Baghdad about 1 hour after the blast. The Bush administration still won't sign a non-aggression pact with North Korea. That at the conclusion of 3 days of talks between the US, North Korea, South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia. At the summit in Beijing, North Korea repeated its position that it would scrap its nuclear weapons program if the Bush administration guaranteed in writing that America would not attack. But US negotiators refused. From Seoul, Aaron Glantz has more.
We agreed to solve this problem peacefully, and we agreed to a denuclearized Korean peninsula, South Korea's deputy foreign minister told reporters at the conclusion of 3 days of talks in Beijing. China's vice foreign minister Wang Yi sounded a similar note.
There was a wide consensus that the North Korean nuclear issue should be resolved by all the parties acting at the same time, side by side.
No American official spoke at the end of the talks, but earlier this week, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said disdain for North Korea was official American government policy. L. Gordon Flake is executive director of the Mansfield Foundation. He says despite the talks, there is a growing consensus inside the Bush administration in favor of overthrowing Kim Jong-il. But not, he says, by war.
There seems to be a general recognition that if you're going to do anything short of war, only way you're going to affect the regime change is by getting China eventually to agree to cut off heavy fuel oil, to cut off even food to North Korea, but not to do that in isolation, to do that in accompanying with opening the border. And if you can do that, the belief is that you can affect refugee flows of such magnitude that you could, in a relatively short order, bring around some dramatic shifts and change in the regime.
The humanitarian consequences of such a policy could be disastrous. Already there are more than 300,000 North Korean refugees living in China. The refugees are not allowed to work legally, and the current Chinese government policy is to hunt them down and forcibly deport them back to North Korea. Two journalists are currently in prison in China for reporting about North Korean refugees, including a freelancer for the New York Times. Inku Kang is active in a campaign to free the two journalists. He's also part of a conservative group that helps a limited number of North Korean refugees seek shelter in foreign embassies in Beijing. He supports regime change in North Korea.
Without nuclear weapon, Kim Jong-il is nothing. Everybody gonna just peck on him, just rip him into pieces. Just he will be down. He will be gone without nuclear weapon. I mean, that's lifeline for him. Kim Jong-il gotta know, without opening his country, he will go down.
But such a hardline approach could have the opposite effect. In a speech Wednesday, North Korean President Kim Jong-il demanded the United States resume shipments of food and oil, expand humanitarian aid, and sign a non-aggression treaty. If it did so, he said, his country would stop its nuclear program. George Katsiafikas, president of the Peace Island Foundation, says the human rights situation in North Korea would improve with a change in American policy.
Who has been the main violator of human rights in North Korea? Clearly the United States has, using economic blockades, using all these weapons against North Korea. If there were no threat of war from the United States, would the government of North Korea be able to relax some of its controls? I think so. And so really, when we look at the causes of the problems of North Korea, you can't help but go to the, you know, number one on the list, being the United States war and the continuing economic and military war that the U.S. is waging.
As the talks wound down in Beijing, the U.S. and South Korean militaries wrapped up their largest joint military exercise ever. Close to 15,000 troops participated in the war game. The American Air Force built a tent city for soldiers to rest at during the operation. The military calls the rest area a safe haven for the warfighter to rest and relax, and then get ready to fight the war. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glanz with Eunji Kang in Seoul.
In the aftermath of the August 14 power outage, utilities successfully lobbied President Bush to weaken clean air rules. As announced this week, power plants, including the dirtiest in the country, can upgrade without installing pollution controls. But in Minnesota, grassroots organizing is defying the Bush administration. Bowing to public pressure, the state's largest supplier of electricity has submitted a voluntary proposal to convert its two oldest and dirtiest coal-burning plants to natural gas. But as FSRN's Anne Alquist reports from Minneapolis, communities are asking, at what price?
Elizabeth Dickinson didn't get any kind of warning about air quality in her neighborhood. She really didn't need one. She says she couldn't avoid noticing the pollution in the air.
A couple years ago, there was almost a week where the air quality in my neighborhood was so bad that you literally couldn't sleep. There was a burning in the back of my throat.
Dickinson lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, not too far from one of the oldest coal-burning plants operated by Minnesota's leading supplier of electricity, Xcel Energy. She and many other people have been actively working to pressure the company to address the air quality problems they believe are caused by Xcel's older plants. And in a rare move among power companies, Xcel Energy is doing something. In May 2002, the company put forth a voluntary proposal to convert its two oldest coal-burning plants to natural gas. The oldest plant, Riverside, lies in northeast Minneapolis. Since it opened in 1911, the Riverside plant has changed very little when it comes to emitting pollutants. It was grandfathered in under the Clean Air Act of 1970, which means the plant isn't subject to federal environmental mandates. It didn't have to install modern pollution control devices unless it upgraded the plant. And now, under the Bush administration's new rules put into place Wednesday, the plant can avoid further upgrades. The Great Lakes Program Coordinator for the Sierra Club, Emily Green, says that means dirtier air and dirtier water.
The Great Lakes are like a giant bathtub with a very, very slow drain, so that what we put into the Great Lakes stays there.
And that's why Xcel's decision to convert Riverside to natural gas is such a big deal. Once it's converted, the old plant will cut air pollutants by 99%. Mercury emissions will be completely eliminated. While the natural gas conversion won't reduce the level of mercury in the Great Lakes immediately, it will mean it won't add to the problem. Ron Elsner is the project manager for Xcel's proposal.
The new combined cycles that we're going to install are on the order of 30% more efficient than what our current coal cycle is. They do that much better a job converting that energy in the fuel to electricity.
It comes at a cost, though. Xcel estimates converting its Minneapolis and St. Paul plants will amount to $1 billion. By Xcel's estimate, it'll be the most expensive power plant conversion in the history of the United States. And the cost of the conversion will be passed on to its customers. And that's fine by Elizabeth Dickinson. She says she and her neighbors were paying for it in other ways already, such as additional health care costs.
These are the hidden costs of using coal burning, and they're huge. And, you know, they're usually left out of these equations, and we're saying they can't be any longer. They just can't be, because it's too high a cost for us as a society.
The effects of not converting are already apparent. An independent report commissioned from the Environmental Protection Agency says pollution from the oldest and dirtiest power plants kills more than 30,000 Americans each year, almost twice the number of people killed by drunk driving and homicide combined. Government regulators still have to approve the plan. Minnesota's Utilities Commission is holding a final round of public hearings before voting for or against Xcel's proposal to convert to natural gas. If the conversion is approved, it will likely put pressure on other power companies in the Great Lakes region to do the same. In Minneapolis, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ann Olquist.
Over the next 15 years, some 3.3 million U.S. service jobs and $136 billion in wages will be sent offshore to places such as Russia, China, India, the Philippines, and Canada. Until now, the practice has managed to stay under the radar, but it could meet serious opposition as more and more companies like GE, Cisco Systems, Boeing, and IBM search for cheaper labor to cut costs and increase shareholder value. Martha Baskin looks at the larger picture of free trade and free trade agreements, of which the moves overseas by U.S. corporations is an integral part.
13,000 emails may seem modest when an estimated 3.3 billion workers are at risk of losing their jobs to the growing practice of exporting service sector and high-tech jobs abroad, but 13,000 emails to two members of Congress can still generate some heat. For 6 months, workers affiliated with the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, or SPIA, and WashTec, CWA, lobbied two Washington State congressmen, Adam Smith and Jay Inslee, in districts heavily ravaged by offshore job loss. This month, the campaign paid off. Congress's investigative arm, the General Accounting Office, gave the green light to a three-month study that will examine the issue of outsourcing in the global economy. The engineers and tech workers hope the GAO will provide answers to questions companies are hesitant to disclose and that the U.S. government chooses to ignore. What are the benefits, the risks of outsourcing? What is the link with free trade? And what free trade agreements, such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas and the WTO's General Agreement on Trade and Services, ready for expansion this fall, need further scrutiny? SPIA, the Engineering Aerospace Union, knows U.S. Boeing workers are losing jobs to China, Russia, Italy, and South Africa, among other countries.
But pegging one worker here to one worker overseas, it is tough. The companies are very adept, they're very slick at moving the jobs in such a way that it's difficult to make the one-on-one comparison.
Bill Dugovich, spokesperson for SPIA. Boeing's Moscow Design Center is a case in point. 150 engineers were hired in June to complement 750 already employed in Moscow. At the same time, 142 U.S. engineers and technical workers lost their jobs at Boeing. In July, 187 more workers were issued 60-day layoff notices. Boeing's recent decision to outsource the writing of maintenance manuals to Adexis in Chile is another sore point. 260 more jobs gone by the end of the year. The running total for the engineers' union since 9-1-1 is 5,212 jobs. The grand total for layoffs of all U.S.-based Boeing workers in the same time period is nearing 40,000 workers. Boeing's justification for global outsourcing is called market access, or buy-build. A country that buys is one that is in turn given the chance to build, design, or service. Moscow's design center also serves as an example of this strategy. Boeing spokesperson John Kovanovsky.
If you're a company, as we are, that delivers more than 3/4 of its product to sale in other parts of the world, we certainly have a responsibility as well to understand and support some of the local economies in other parts of the world that represent our customers.
Kovanovsky says that Boeing's market share in Russia is 80%, but SPIA's Dugovich and other workers spoken to for this story dispute that and say the strategy is flawed. Russia has yet to purchase any Boeing planes, they say, in exchange for acquiring jobs. Congressman Smith and Inslee, for all their expressed interest in having the GAO study outsourcing, both voted for two new U.S. trade agreements with Singapore and Chile that will exacerbate the practice. The Free Trade Area of the Americas and the WTO's General Agreement on Trade and Services propose to export even more U.S. service jobs. Included in the word service are not only customer service and high-tech service jobs, but anyone who performs a service. Teachers, nurses, park rangers, public transportation workers. All of these jobs will be up for grabs by any corporation in any country. Brent McFarland, a Boeing technical worker and representative to the King County Labor Council.
I don't know how the Singapore-Chile free trade agreements figure into this, but it just seems like no coincidence that, you know, companies are already lining up to send their work to this country before the agreement's even been signed.
Still, Congressman Smith's office says that the GAO study will provide the information he needs to start developing what he's calling a national jobs and industrial plan for the country. Three ranking Democrats, George Miller, Charles Rangel, and Ike Skelton, share his interest. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
A woman sentenced to death by stoning under Islamic law has appealed against the sentence to a higher Islamic appeals court in northern Nigeria. The woman, Amina Lawal, had earlier lost an appeal against the death sentence at a lower appeals court. Her battle to stay alive is coming as Nigerian President Obasanjo, who is under pressure from Western countries, is planning legislation to abolish the death penalty. Human rights groups have hailed the move. But in the predominantly Muslim north of the country, there's outrage. Muslims say the death penalty should not be abolished because it's an important aspect of Islamic law. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Allah!
This was how the death sentence on the woman, Amina Lawal, was confirmed by an Islamic court in northern Nigeria. Amina Lawal, who was condemned to death under Islamic law for committing adultery, has taken her case to a higher appeal court. Like most African countries, Nigeria's law provides for the death penalty. But following pressure from Western countries, President Olusegun Obasanjo is planning a legislation to abolish it. Chima Ubani is head of Nigeria's largest human rights group, the Civil Liberties Organization.
No form of punishment can be more inhuman, can be more unusual than the death penalty.
He says such inhuman and unusual punishments include death sentence by stoning, which the woman Amina Lawal is facing. Many death sentences carried out in Nigeria have turned out not only inhuman, but also controversial. The Ogoni people sing a song in memory of the playwright and environmentalist Ken Saruhuwa. The activist was involved in a struggle against the multinational oil company Shell Petroleum. The military government of General Abacha, which was making a lot of money from crude oil sales, executed Ken Saruhuwa after a controversial trial before a tribunal. Facts that emerged later showed that the military government hid under the law to eliminate Saruhuwa on account of his struggle against the activities of Shell Petroleum in his homeland. Contrary to claims that the military council studied the judgment before ratifying it as required by law, facts show that the military government hurriedly executed him even before receiving copies of the judgment. The human rights activist Chuma Ubani says the death penalty has to go so as to prevent such miscarriage of justice.
One of the arguments we have against the death penalty is that once the punishment is inflicted, it is final. And even if at the end of the day it is found that it was done in error, there can be no remedy.
But in Nigeria's predominantly Muslim north, where Islamic law is being enforced, there is anger against any move to stop the death penalty. Like many other Nigerian Muslims, Umar Abubakar says the death penalty is a law from God which no one should attempt to abolish.
If the laws of God are not adhered to, there can never be peace. There can never be progress. It is only when the laws of God are adhered to that there can be peace.
Emotions among Nigerian Muslims are running high. Some of them have threatened to cause civil disturbance if the death penalty is abolished. It is believed that the Nigerian government will back down in the face of the strong reaction from the Muslim community. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at WBAI by Kata Mesta. Headlines editors from WMNF in Tampa, Florida are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abrams. Our DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Technical producers at KPFA in Berkeley are Jade Padgett-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone. We have web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.